Hi, I'm Dr. Hans Sabarg, the Senior Medical Director for WebMD, Senior Medical Correspondent for Medscape, and today I have the privilege of having Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha with me today. We will be talking about the lead crisis. Dr. Hanna-Attisha, thank you so much for being here, and if you're okay with it, I'll refer to you as Mona here on in.
Sounds great. It's great to be with you.
Great. The lead crisis in Flint, Michigan, which began in 2014 when the city switched its water supply, quickly escalated into a national story and prompted then-President Obama to declare a federal state of emergency in January 2016. While the change in water supply prompted almost immediate complaints from citizens, it was not until 18 months later that a lead advisory was issued to residents. That advisory, in part, was prompted by a study by Mona Hanna-Attisha, MD, and colleagues. It was published several months earlier and documented a doubling of elevated blood lead levels in children, especially in socioeconomically disadvantaged neighborhoods. Now, almost 2 years following that belated acknowledgement, Dr. Hanna-Attisha has been working diligently with the children in Flint. Medscape is now speaking with Dr. Hanna-Attisha about the current state of this issue and lessons learned for other communities. Mona, I'm going to jump right into it, and we are all interested to hear, can you tell us the state of affairs in your hometown now? The city has gone back to its original water source. Has that reduced the exposure to lead, or are children still being exposed?
Yeah, that's a great question. Really, kind of, where are we right now in Flint? So we are 4 years past the water switch. So we're in our fourth year after those water crisis started. Yet to this day, the people of Flint, the kids that I take care in clinic every day, are still on filtered water and they're still on bottled water. So even though shortly after, you know, our research came out and shortly after the declaration that there was lead in the water, we went back to treated water. Yet the 18 months that we were on untreated water, this corrosive water ate up our pipes. And because of that, the water is still not safe. It is absolutely getting better. And most importantly, the pipes are being replaced. Our lead service lines, which are the pipes that go from a person's house to the water main, are being replaced. But that takes time, and it's not estimated to be completed until 2020. So until then, the people are still on filtered water and still on bottled water. However, the quality of the water has improved.
Now, are most of your patients and the communities aware of this? Are there any families that may not know this and are using the water from the taps?
Yeah, so I think that is one of our continuous struggles, is to keep people informed of the current water situation. There's been a lot of mixed messages throughout the crisis. At the beginning, people were told to boil their water because of bacteria, and boiling water actually concentrates lead in whatever you're cooking. And then they were told to flush their water, and then they were told to filter their water, but not to filter hot water. And then they were told the filters don't work because there was so much lead in the water that the filters didn't have a maximal clearance for that lead amount. And then they said that they tested the filters even for the super high levels of lead in water and they still work. So use your filter. So there's been a lot of mixed messages, which has caused obvious confusion with our patients. But I think at this point that the message is out, that the water is still not safe, that you should use filters, that you should use bottled water. There's still water delivery programs and there's still what we call pods in the community where people can pick up water. There's also a home door-to-door program where there's folks that have come to people's homes to help install the water filters because they're not super easy to figure out. You install them in the end of your kitchen faucet. There's a light indicator that means you need to replace your cartridge. Depending how much lead has been through your system, people are on, say, their 12th or 15th replacement cartridges. So our work is ongoing in terms of educating and informing the public to keep taking precautions.
Now, we know that there are parts of the nation that are also affected. In fact, more and more data is coming out in terms of how many millions of homes are affected. So for the physicians who are treating patients who may be in affected areas, what types of filters would you advise physicians to suggest?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Flint is not an isolated story. There is lead and in water everywhere. So we were stubbornly slow as a nation to restrict lead in our paint, in our gasoline, in our different things, but especially in our plumbing. The word plumbing actually comes from the word lead. So the elemental symbol for lead is PB. It comes from plumbum. It's the Latin word for plumbing. So as a nation, we didn't restrict lead in our service lines, those main pipes, until 1986. And we didn't restrict lead actually in our brass fixtures until 2014. So people are testing in schools and communities, and they are finding lead in their water. In addition, the lead and copper rule, which regulates lead in the water, it's part of the Safe Drinking Water Act, is very weak. It has no regulations on testing in schools, daycare facilities. It has not caught up with the science of lead. The science of lead, the amazing science, has taught us there's no safe level. Yet the action levels are not health-based standards. So there is lead in water everywhere. So if people want to take maximum precautions, they should be using lead clearing filters. There's only a specific kind of filters that actually clear lead. They're called NSF 53 certified lead clearing filters. So they have to make sure that when they buy a filter, it is specifically a lead clearing filter. And I would recommend that for vulnerable populations like pregnant moms, like babies who are in formula that is being mixed with tap water. That's when your child's neurodevelopment is growing rapidly. That's when you should take the greatest precautions.
Absolutely. And let's just talk about what impact lead may have. It's been long recognized as a neurotoxin, but the wide-scale exposure that occurred in so many children and could occur highlights this as truly significant. Can you speak to some of the previously less recognized negative outcomes?
Yeah, so I think, lead is a well-studied neurotoxin, like you said. We've known what lead has done for centuries. Back in the day, we used to see kids with severe neurologic disorders, seizures, convulsions, coma, because of super high lead levels, specifically probably from lead in the gasoline. We had polluted our entire environment because we had lead in our gasoline. And we didn't really worry about the lower levels. But then over the last few decades, some really brave, heroic environmental health superstars and pediatricians like Herb Needleman and Phil Landrigan and Bruce Lamphere have really taught us what the lower levels of lead does. So actually dropping IQ levels, leading to behavior problems like ADHD, conduct disorder, causing hematologic disorders. It's now been linked to things like hypertension, kidney disease, gout, early dementia. So it impacts almost every organ system and really every age range, but because of the rapidly growing development of a child, we worry about them the most. Biophysically, lead actually replaces calcium. So whenever calcium is in any kind of metabolic profile, it replaces calcium. It limits neuronal connections. So it has this kind of wide array, but the most worrying part is what it does to the nervous system, especially the developing nervous system.
Right. And as pediatricians, we're seeing a rise in ADHD. So the question does become, how much does environment influence this? And it's hard to distinguish, right, Mona?
Absolutely. And with all environmental health issues, proving causation is very difficult. Lead is known as a silent pediatric epidemic because we don't see the consequences right away. We see it for this lag time. We see it years and maybe decades and maybe generations later. We are now learning about the epigenetics of lead. Moms exposed to lead, you can see DNA methylation changes in their grandchildren. And in addition, the consequences of things like lead exposure are multifactorial. If I see a kid in clinic this afternoon and diagnose them with ADHD, was he always supposed to have ADHD? Well, did he have a family history of ADHD? Or could this water, the lead exposure, contributed to that? So it is very difficult to pinpoint the causation with all environmental health issues. Fortunately, the management is the same. And most importantly, environmental health, it's primary prevention. It's making sure those children are never exposed.
Yeah, it is a silent epidemic. But, your work and getting the word out there really, really is helping. Let me ask you about the management of these children. So once you see children with lead levels, do we have the support systems available to help them? Because there's long-term cascading consequences, right?
Yeah, so those support services nationally really are not in place. The treatment for lead is prevention. So there's no cure, there's no antidote, there's not much that we can do to reverse, to eliminate that exposure. However, there is a lot that we can do to buffer, to mitigate, to make sure that we do not see those consequences. And this is what in public health we call secondary prevention. Now that you already have this exposure, What do we do to not see the consequences? And that is where my work is every day in Flint, putting in place what science has taught us promotes development so we don't see the consequences. So now in Flint, we have robust early education services, high quality childcare, universal preschool, early literacy investment, parenting support, healthcare access, nutrition support. Nutrition plays a critical role in lead. So we're putting into place all of these things that evidence, science has taught us promote development. But these are common sense things. These are things that all children need. All children need home visiting programs, breastfeeding support, great nutrition, early education, access to books. So we are really kind of leveling the playing field for these children to make sure that we do not see the consequences of this lead exposure.
So if you, and, you know, I asked this, you know, in tongue in cheek a little bit, but if you were in charge of everything, Mona, would you put your resources into all of the areas that you just described, or would you put resources into testing the children? I mean, what I'm getting at is routine screening of children at 1 and 2 years of age sufficient, or do we do all these other additional measures?
Yeah, so I've thought a lot about testing of children recently, and it's come up a lot since Flint because testing rates are so low. Over a decade ago, the CDC recommended universal testing. Every kid should be tested at 1 and 2. And then as those rates of elevated lead levels came down, they moved to more targeted and high-risk testing. So not that many kids are tested anymore. In Flint, where really most children should be tested because Medicaid mandates testing at 1 and 2, our screening rates before the crisis were only about 40%. So we're not identifying the children that are exposed. But we are using children as really canaries of environmental exposure. And we should not be testing children. We should be testing environments. Yes. Before we ever detect lead in a child, we should be testing their water, their paint, their soil, their dust. Because like I said, when we check it in a child, it is too late. So this is the whole point of primary prevention. And there's some really innovative best practices out there. For example, in Massachusetts, before a child moves into a home, that home needs to be checked for lead exposure. There's some home visiting programs that check the child's environment before the child is diagnosed. This is where we need to be heading. Yes, we do need to increase testing of children as well. But more importantly, we need to be shifting our paradigm. We need to be checking environments rather than checking children. Checking environments before a child is exposed rather than after a child is exposed, and thus devoting resources after the exposure.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the levels of lead that are found in children, there's really no scientific evidence in terms of what is a high level and what is not a high level. And even the EPA's levels that are safe are potentially based on not amazing science. Am I right about that?
So the scientific community, the CDC, the American Academy of Pediatrics, agrees that there's no safe level of lead in a child. There is no high level, low level. There is no safe level of lead in a child. Currently, the reference level for lead in your blood is 5 micrograms per deciliter. This does not mean this is an elevated level. This is just the reference level. Based on national data, 2.5% of children who are tested are above that level. So there is no safe level in child. However, the levels that the EPA and the CDC have set for lead in water, lead in paint, lead in soil, lead in dust, have not caught up with the science of no safe level lead. For example, the EPA's action level for lead in water is 15 parts per billion. The World Health Organization's action level for lead in water is 10 parts per billion. The FDA, which actually regulates lead in water, has set a standard of 5 parts per billion for bottled water. So what we have at the EPA is a standard based on feasibility. It's the feasibility of water utilities meeting this guideline. It is not a health-based standard. If it was a health-based standard, it would be 0 or 1 parts per billion. And that is what the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended in their most recent guideline on lead exposure. They recommended that lead in water should not exceed 1 part per billion in childcare facilities and in daycares. That's where we need to be going. We need to advocate for stronger regulations to cut these action levels down to match the science that we now know of no safe level of lead.
Let me ask you, steer away a little bit from children and talk about pregnant women. So you talked about in Massachusetts testing the home before a child moves into the home. What about pregnant women? Should the environment or they be routinely screened?
Absolutely. So, and ACOG, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, does have some guidelines that needs to be, I think, re-strengthened about testing pregnant women. Really, it should be preconception of their lead exposure. It's pregnancy and childbirth. These are big moments in people's lives. And it's often the times when people embark on, for example, renovation projects. Let's fix up a nursery and let's do it ourselves and learn on YouTube how to fix up a nursery. And we'll scrape the paint off the wall and we'll sand this down and we'll open to get all this dust exposure. And it's often at those times when the most high risk folks are being exposed to more lead because of these projects. So there's a lot of education that needs to be done at these really critical points of a child's development and obviously in utero to limit exposure. So yeah, there's an opportunity for education and there's an opportunity of screening and preconception.
Do you think that pregnant women should just universally be told to drink bottled water?
I do. Or filtered water, or if they have a lead clearing filter. So, before the Flint crisis, I was not naive, but I trusted that when I turned on my tap in America in this century, that the water was safe and it was tested. I imagined people in white coats whose job was charged with protecting our drinking water supply. I no longer believe that. Mm-hmm. And I know these regulations they're not strong. I know there's a lot of gaming of the regulations, the gaming of the sampling of lead and water. So if you cannot guarantee that there is no lead in your entire distribution system from when the water leaves the water treatment center until you turn on your tap, that there's no lead in your solder, in your brass fixtures, in your service line, then you're okay. But if you can't guarantee that, why not protect the health and development of your child and ensure that you're drinking filtered water?
That's really good advice, and I think it's less known, so that's a really good message that you're putting out there. Mona, I suspect you didn't plan to become a nationally recognized champion for public health, but we're really glad you are. What personally were your biggest lessons, and what message would you convey to family doctors, pediatricians, nurse practitioners that are taking care of all these children?
Yeah, so what I did and what I continue to do every day is part of my job. So I am a pediatrician. I took an oath when I became a doctor to protect my community, to be their healer, to be, to fight for my kids. So I have done nothing that is not part of my job description, especially as a pediatrician, using my voice, using kind of my skill set to make sure that my children, either the children I see individually in clinic or the children that are part of my larger community, are protected. I think especially as pediatricians, so much of what we do is prevention. We see a kid for their well-child visit, and we talk about eating well, and we talk about exercise, and we talk about helmet safety and car seat safety. So much of what we are doing is making sure that our children are healthy today. But really more than that, all that anticipatory guidance is making sure that our children are healthy tomorrow. And this crisis was a really a perfect example of a threat to the tomorrows of our children. So it was definitely in my professional duty, in everyone's professional duty as a physician, to stand up, to walk out of our clinics, to walk out of our classrooms, to walk out of our labs, and advocate for our communities. So I think physicians should kind of take that oath again and remember that this is our duty. And I think it's very comfortable for us often to stay in our offices and our clinics and our exam rooms and our classrooms and our labs. But if there ever was a time, I think it's a time for us to really to get out there and to fight, because there's quite a few injustices out there that are threatening the health and development of our patients.
Well, thank you very, very much, Mona. And we really appreciate your time and your incredible efforts in this area. I do think, as a pediatrician myself, that prevention is key, and activism is really important as well, as you suggested, to get out there and make sure the messages are being heard and policies are changing. But I do want to thank you. Medscape thanks you, and we congratulate you on your efforts and hope to see lots more from you. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's been great.